of the news. I'm Rick Hellett. Well, it's our Friday news roundup, and we begin with our WFPL roundtable of Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Erica Peterson. We invite you to join us at 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Toll free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. You can send us an email, news@WFPL.org. Send us a tweet, WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. And we begin the program, as you may have heard Stan mention a couple of minutes ago, with some breaking news. The resignation of 1st District Metro Councilwoman Judy Green just occurred in the last hour and a half or so. And Philip M. Bailey, this kind of caps a flurry of activity this week in the Green case.
Yes, I think that collectively everyone is sort of taken aback because there were so many mixed reports. As you said, Councilwoman Judy Green did resign from office effective immediately in a resignation letter that was given to the council clerk's office at 11:48 this morning. That was delivered by her attorney, Mr. Derwin Webb. It came a few minutes after actually the council court had delivered a stinging blow of its own. The council court chairman delivering, Kelly Downer delivering an order. Essentially, everyone was confused because everyone expected that Councilman Green would resign last night, mm-hmm. either at the Metro Council meeting or at a rally of supporters. That was what the expectation was among many. There had been reports, sources in City Hall had said they had seen Councilman Green and her husband removing boxes from her district office. She later denied that at the rally that Devin attended. So there were many people who, depending on who you talk to, saying, well, she's going to resign now, she's going to resign later. No, she's not going to resign at all. She continued that line at that rally, but this comes as a surprise for, I think, a lot of people who were just, this story, like I said, has been in the news for over a year now. And the questions now turn to whether the trial will continue on Monday.
Well, that was my next question. What happens next? Now, does the council have to accept her resignation at a council meeting? And who decides if this trial will go ahead?
According to council rules, a resignation is not official until it is read into the record. That's why many were wondering if she was going to resign before last night's council meeting, so it could be read into the record then. At this point, that means that her resignation will not be read into the record until September 22nd, when the next Metro Council meeting convenes in City Hall. That is obviously after the September 12th beginning of the expulsion trial. There are some who believe that it's really up to the council court. If they decide, as Michael Connell wrote in an opinion to the charging committee, the court could go forward with these charges, which effectively would bar Councilman Green from running for office until 2014. By her resigning, she could effectively run for office again in 2012 if she sees or wanted to. So it's really up to the court if they will decide to go ahead with the trial on September 12th, but it's still scheduled to begin at 12:30 on Monday. And at this point, everything seems to appears to be going in the same motion that it was before.
There were a lot of questions as to whether she was going to step down. Yesterday, she was apparently seen carrying boxes out of her Metro Council office. And then we'll turn to Devin here in just a moment. There was a pro-Green rally last night, Devin, at which she said she would not step down.
She definitely gave that impression that she was not going to step down, which I think surprise from some parts of the community are surprised that she didn't resign earlier. But I think the community, District 1 community, was surprised. This will come to a surprise to them once they start hearing about this. Yesterday was attended by around 50 community members. There's about 10 media people that were also there. Around 7 people got up to speak. Each one had different things to say. Some people compared the struggle that she was going through to similarities with Martin Luther King Jr.'s struggle. Some people had faith-based things to say. Other people were directed towards specific things that have been ongoing with Judy Green's with the community and with what the ethics violations that she's had. We have some audio that we're going to be playing in a second, and I think it really encompasses the evening and different people's opinions. And here it is.
No peace! No peace! No peace!
It ain't over. They want to take matters into their own hands and exclude us from the process, but go ahead. Because it ain't over. They want to walk all over city policies and procedures and replace them with their own hip pocket policies. Go right ahead, because it ain't over.
Those young people needed jobs, and they got them. Where like some other people have said. That was the first thing I thought about this. What is wrong with the rest of those council people that they haven't been...
They still could have said, well, we'll issue them a fine, a reprimand, a censure. They chose not to. Now, when you remove an elected official, let me tell you what the immediate effects of that is. That is disenfranchisement.
They say she didn't fill out the forms right, y'all. That's all. They say she didn't fill out the forms right. And they're trying to take her job away because she didn't fill out the forms right. Well, you know, we need more people on Metro Council, like Sister Judy Green. We need more people on Metro Council, like Sister Judy Green.
We understand that once you learn how to play the game, they change the rules. You are not wrong because you break a bad rule. Dr. King broke the rules every day. A runaway slave was breaking a rule. But sister, you're not alone in this. That's what we want you to know.
And I think what you hear there is a lot of people are concerned that what's going to happen is that their community, their district is going to be disenfranchised. What a big theme throughout the night was what Judy Green was doing was right for her community, regardless of what's happening in Metro Council and the ethics concerned with that. What she was doing in her district was good for the people there.
And there were some speakers who called out the media as well, right?
Yeah, there was a couple situations. I mean, Judy Green herself called out some members of the media. Definitely, Courier Journal was called out. Some media television reporters were called out by name. She also gave some commendment to some of the reporters, some television reporters. I can't recall their names right now, but she also said that they were doing an all right job.
And this is a group called Concerned Citizens of the First District. And it remains to be seen now, Philip, what this group is going to do given her resignation. Right?
Yes, I mean, considering that, I mean, at this point, what we saw was the kitchen sink strategy, I think, at the end here, where there was a mix of sort of a religious dogma comparing Councilman Green to Jesus Christ and civil rights language comparing her to Martin Luther King. Many felt that, you know, Councilwoman Green was being singled out because she was African American. It certainly didn't help that you had bloggers and others making comments comparing Councilwoman Green's supporters to the Help, literally comparing her supporters to black maids. So that certainly added an element of racial tension in it. But when I talked to Jesse Harris, a spokesman for Concerned Citizens of District 1, he admitted that residents and supporters of Councilwoman Green didn't necessarily know all the facts of the ethics cases. When you get into the details of that her children were paid more in the program than other children, the fact that her husband ran the program, which he had denied initially in December but later admitted to in March of 2011, when you started getting some of these details, supporters of hers will literally say, well, I didn't know about that. And therefore, they're pointing to the good works indeed she did with youth and job creation more than the actual issues and facts of the ethics case. One of the reasons I think that Councilman Green ended up resigning is that, like I said earlier, Councilman Kelly Downard, who's the chair of the council court at 11:30, he had issued a stinging order barring Councilman Green's defense from introducing any witnesses or exhibits because her attorney had not filed a witness list or sent any documentation or subpoenas to the council court for any documentation. So you see those, I think, that was part of the reason for her resignation, that she would have walked into that trial and she couldn't have introduced any witnesses. She couldn't have introduced any evidence whatsoever. There was, when we get down to the real world here, of the facts outside of the political rhetoric, there was very little for her case to stand on.
So just to encapsulate all this, Judy Green has submitted her resignation effective immediately. That was shortly before noon today. But as far as we know now, this removal trial could move forward on Monday. Gabe?
I I talked with Catherine Parks, a member of Concerned Citizens for District 1, who had sought the seat in 2005, correct, when it was first opened?
Yeah.
She said that they still stand behind Councilwoman Green and that if she decides to run again in the future, in 2012 or 2014, depending on the council actions, they will support her. Catherine Parks has no plans to seek an appointment to the seat at this time.
And to add a caveat to that, someone who was very close to Councilwoman Green just told me before we came on State of the News today that it seems that she's not interested in running for the seat ever again, that she seems to literally be exhausted with this process. I mean, whatever people think about Councilwoman Green, supporters or critics, like I said, this story has been in the news for a year now. Continuous scrutiny of not only her and her activities on the Metro Council. She probably, in any race, she would run to seek the office again if she were to seek to run on the Metro Council, would probably be one of the more closely watched races. Certainly, she's become one of the more divisive figures in Metro government's short history.
All right, Philip, thank you. And Devin, on the Judy Green story, and we're going to stick with you, Gabe, for a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL, and we welcome your participation, 502-814-8255. That's 814-TALK or toll-free 877-814-8255. Gabe, let's talk about the Louisville Orchestra contract talks with the musicians. Where do we stand now?
Well, they're still far apart at this point. The concerts now for November have been canceled. Previously, the orchestra management canceled concerts for September and October because they couldn't reach an agreement with the musicians. The musicians are advocating for, right now they're saying they would like 60 full-time players instead of 71, but that number would be rebuilt over following seasons, and they would like the season to go from 37 to 35 weeks. That's the offer they've put out. The orchestra management says that can't be done, that they can't afford that. They've offered this tier system when some musicians would be signed for about 10 weeks, others would be signed for up to 30 weeks, and they say that's the only way the orchestra can continue. So as these sides remain at a disagreement without finding this middle ground there, if there is middle ground, then the orchestra cannot perform. They have to cancel concerts 2 months in advance, and the deadline for November rehearsals came around, or not rehearsals, the deadline for to tell ticket holders, to tell guest artists, all of that came around, and concerts have been called off for another month.
Now, how long can this go on before it would affect the entire season?
I believe until May, so 2 months before May, I guess it would get around to March, sometime in the spring. That could mean an entirely dark season. The orchestra has some other things that it does without the musicians. The management structure has a few things happening that they can do without holding actual performances, but most people think of the orchestra, they think of those performances that they have with the guest artists or just as the orchestra themselves, and those aren't going on. They have said in a statement, the orchestra management has said that any guest artists have agreed to or in talks to come back for another season. Another point here, and I'm hoping to find this out this afternoon, we haven't heard yet whether the orchestra management will take up Mayor Greg Fisher on his offer to use money from an anonymous donor to bring in an outside consultant, a nationally renowned consultant that they could pay with this money from this donation. The musicians are in favor of it. This is something they pushed for before. The management had declined largely because of financial concerns, but also because, as Orchestra CEO Rob Berman told me last week, they felt that with the musicians' union at the table, with the orchestra board at the table, and with the management at the table, they felt that they had enough expertise.
Let's take a call. Frank is in Shepherdsville, and he has an orchestra-related question. Hello, Frank. You're on State of the News. What's your question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call, first off.
Sure.
I have a question comment type of situation. I was wondering if it would be feasible to be able to enact a 25-cent surcharge on all tickets that are sold in entertainment venues, be it theater, Churchill Downs, concerts. That 25 cent would then go into a fund for the orchestra, and this is one way the city of Louisville, the people of Louisville and Jefferson County, could support the orchestra. And I don't think, you know, a 25 cent surcharge is going to stop anybody from going to see a concert or going to the track.
All right.
I'll take the comment on off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Frank. Has this been talked about, Gabe, that you know of?
Not this exact proposal, but during the mayor's race, we heard some conversations around the idea of an arts tax, some sort of fee that would be paid by residents of Metro Louisville, whether that would be on just on payroll, I don't think so, or whether that would come out of payroll, or whether that would be, say, on tickets on hotel room nights or something like that, or hotel beds, whether wherever that tax would be, there was some discussion of having an extra fee to support the arts that didn't really go too far, because after the inauguration, we had heard from members of Mayor Fisher's staff that there really isn't much desire to talk about any sort of new tax.
This is State of the News on WFPL. We have our Friday WFPL roundup of Metro News with WFPL news staff. We've been talking early in the program about a late-breaking story, the resignation late this morning of First District Councilwoman Judy Green. She submitted her resignation effective immediately. She was due to stand a trial of sorts in the Metro Council, a removal proceeding. But that remains to be seen whether or not that will go on. Now, we do have a caller who wants to make a comment about the Judy Green case. John from Louisville is with us. John, hello. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Yes, I'd just like to say that, you know, I feel like the action against Green has gone a little bit too far because, you know, frankly, they act as though this money were stolen. But every nickel of it went to pay people that actually did work.
I see. Now, Philip, there was a police investigation into this, correct?
Yeah, the police investigation, and I think the point that John makes is, one of the Councilwoman Green supporters often make, is that there were no criminal charges filed against Councilwoman Green, even though the Public Integrity Unit of the Louisville Metro Police Department looked into the money that was spent for the Green Clean Team. I don't think that anyone ever, I think that Mr. Barker may have initially said that there was money that was stolen. But the charges around the Ethics Commission and the internal audit focused on money that was unaccounted for, $28,000 of which still the county attorney's office is still sending letters to the Life Institute asking for them to account for that $28,000. Like I said, the devil is in the details here in regards to where that money was actually spent and how it was spent, meaning that Dr. Eddie Woods, at least before the Ethics Commission, he alleged that his signature was forged at least 18 different times on checks and receipts written to young people. Some of the young people who were in the program, he didn't recognize the names. And in many situations, Councilwoman Green herself or her staff were filling out the receipt books for the children who were paid in the program, giving it to the Life Institute. The Life Institute, in turn, giving her the money to pay the kids at a later date. It was discovered, like I said earlier, that during the Green Clean Team, that her children were paid on average more than children who weren't related to her in the program. I believe her children were paid around $300 on average, whereas the average youth participant in the Green Clean Team was paid about $150 or $190. So that disparity was really what the devil in the details of what the Ethics Commission found and made its ruling for.
John, are you still there?
Yes. Did they work more hours, though?
It's unclear. Yeah, that's another thing I think that came up during the ethics hearing, which is that because Councilwoman Green and her staff were filling out some of this paperwork, Councilwoman Green did claim that sometimes her children would work more hours or that they stayed there more often than some of the other kids. But it was unclear because she and her staff were filling out that paperwork. And because the ethics law, I think, forbids council members to be directly involved in those programs, it really became a question for the ethics panel, at least, a question of conflict of interest.
John, do you live in the First District?
No, I'm nearby, though. I'm, I'm right the next district over.
All right. Well, we appreciate
downtown area.
We appreciate your call this afternoon. Thanks for calling. This is State of the News on WFPL, and you can call us at 502-814-8255 or toll free 877-814-8255 or 814-TALK. Let's move on to another topic. Erica Peterson, WFPL environment reporter, is with us. Erica, you reported this week on there are discussions of a settlement with a Kentucky coal company over alleged violations of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, and this is kind of a similar issue that we have been seeing in the news for a while. Basically, an environmental group started going through the records in the Kentucky Cabinet of Energy and the Environment and found that there were a lot of, duplicates among water monitoring reports. And the way this works is that coal companies and a lot of other polluters have to fill out these reports that basically to account for their pollution. And the environmental groups, including Appalachian Voices, which is based in North Carolina, found that a lot of that data had just been duplicated. It was, you know, they had filled out a report for January and it had the exact same numbers as the report for December and the report for November, which they thought was weird. So the cabinet In this latest case, this is with Nally and Hamilton, which is based in Bardstown over a bunch of mines in eastern Kentucky. The cabinet started scrutinizing these forms as well and started issuing letters of violation. But one of the interesting things I found when I started reporting the story was that there's literally nothing. There's one point, perhaps, that both sides agree on. And in this case, the sides have broken down to the state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and Appalachian Voices and the other nonprofits. Appalachian Voices is officially an intervener in the lawsuit. And so the state has proposed a settlement with the coal companies for $507,000 plus some remedial measures. The preliminary word from Appalachian Voices is that they don't think that number is appropriate for the many thousands of violations they say have occurred.
This is a company based in Bardstown that they have coal operations in eastern Kentucky.
Yep, it's a smaller company. It's not one of the ones you hear about all the time, but they do have a lot of mines. And one of the discrepancies between the state and the nonprofits is that they count the violations differently. The state says they found about 4,600 violations in this. Appalachian Voices says they found 41,000. And that's partly because when there's a violation on one day, Appalachian Voices assumes, well, that violation has been going on for a while. We're going to count it for 30 days. And the state says, well, it's just been going on one day. But I think the thing to take away from this issue is that there's nothing when paperwork is filed, some of these violations had gone unnoticed for 3 years. And once the cabinet noticed them, they did file these violations. But there's nothing that automatically trips anything. It's not an electronic process where when a company files a report, all of a sudden a red flag goes up and says, oh, you know, this isn't right. So it really does take sometimes some additional action to get these things taken care of.
On another topic, you are just back from a tour of the Ford plant. This is not the truck plant, but the other plant on Fern Valley Road that's undergoing a huge transformation.
Yeah, I honestly did not see it before, so I couldn't tell you tell you the changes. But it's about ready to go. The governor was there as well as the mayor, and they'll be manufacturing the Ford Escape there. They didn't have any cars to show people because they're waiting to unveil that at an auto show later. And the Ford Escape does come in a hybrid version as well, which they will not be making in Louisville right now. But they said if demand picks up or something, they would potentially have the capacity to do that.
This is the Louisville Assembly Plant. I was trying to think of the name of it.
Yes.
Not the Kentucky truck plant. And any timetable on when this is all going to be done?
I think they said December was when they're going to start actually rolling out their earliest models from that.
I believe this is about a $600 million investment.
Right? Yes.
By the company. While we are still here with our Metro segment, we do have someone else who wants to raise a question about the Judy Greene case. Judy Greene resigned this morning from her first district council seat. So let's go back to the phones and Josh in Louisville. Hi, Josh. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a junior at the University of Louisville. I'm a political science major. And the discussion amongst the political science students is concerned that even though, you know, there might not be, you know, too terrible of, of encroachments upon, like, what should I say, the ethics probe, but the concern mainly is why, even though this is a concerning matter about how, even though she it seems like there's a stubbornness there, and then we're in the state level and the federal level, any situation that happens, especially like close to this type of situation, usually wouldn't take longer than a year or around close to a year for a representative elected official to either resign or concede or try to be more.
So, yeah. So you're asking why, what's taken so long for her to step down?
Yeah. Because usually the population or especially her constituents would definitely be concerned about her mm-hmm.
Well, Philip, I don't know what the tipping point was for her, but she vowed up until just this week to fight it out, right?
Yeah, I think if we look back at the situation, Councilman Green made just about every mistake that a political or elected official could make. Never at any point was she ever reconciliatory, or did she ever say that she hadn't done anything wrong. She had maintained throughout, really from the story broke last year up until now, that she had done nothing that was wrong as far as the ethics ordinance was concerned. And I think that, and one thing I think was important to point out was that one of her supporters, someone who was at least sympathetic to her argument, former Councilwoman Denise Bentley, made, I think, an interesting point a few months ago, saying that one of the reasons Councilwoman Green has such sympathy in the community is that people sort of understand, or they sympathize or empathize with her plight, whether it's her personal financial situation, which has been troubled for a number of years, and these issues of ethics, meaning that, as I think as Bob Cunningham pointed out in Devin's piece, that as long as you're doing the right thing, how you do it, it doesn't really matter, that the means justify the ends. So in that way, I think that her stubbornness played out over the year, and many people, I think, and any other politician would have handled this much differently. But Councilwoman Green did win overwhelming support in these elections that when she was elected to the Metro Council, and she felt that the majority of the residents were and stayed behind her.
All right, before we run out of time here, I want to get one last word in from Devin Katayama here. Of course, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 coming up on Sunday, and there are some local observances.
Yeah, and the public is invited to these city events. The city's going to be holding an honorary event for the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks in Waterfront Park at the Great Lawn at 2 o'clock. They're going to be presenting a piece of the World Trade Center that was given to around 10 cities around the United States. So that will be presented by some firefighters and police of Louisville. And at 1 o'clock, there'll be a moment of remembrance. This is a nationwide kind of moment. And you have 1 minute at 1 o'clock to remember the event however you wish, and people can do what they want. TARC buses will stop for that 1 minute at 1 o'clock. From 1 o'clock to 1:01, they're going to pull over and participate.
And Gabe Buller, we're going to have some special programming on Sunday as well.
We will. NPR is carrying a few different specials, or two specials mainly. One will be 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday until 5 p.m., 6 p.m. if you count Weekend All Things Considered as well. Special programming of some of the remembrances happening, some of the speeches that are happening, and some of the moments of silence that will be going on. There will also be a concert on Sunday evening, and we will be broadcasting that as well.
All right. Thanks, Gabe. And to Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, and Devin Katayama. As always, great work this week, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
When we come back, we're going to talk to Jim Carroll of the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau about a reaction to President Obama's jobs proposal unveiled last night. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, President Barack Obama is proposing an ambitious, nearly $450 billion jobs plan to Congress, whose key feature is a sizable 2012 payroll tax cut for workers and employers. The package represents the president's response to stubbornly high unemployment and a weak economic recovery. He, of course, presented it to a joint session of Congress last night and has begun selling it to the public today. I believe he had a stop sometime this morning in Richmond, Virginia. Here to tell us how it's playing among Kentucky and Indiana's Capitol Hill delegation is James Carroll at the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your cell phone sounds good there, so I think we're in good shape.
Thanks.
So what are you hearing today? Let's start with the Republicans, who make up the majority of the delegations. Is there any part of this that's palatable to them?
Well, based on what they're saying publicly at the moment, anything that looks or smells like additional spending, they're not going to be for. That appears to be at least the initial take from pretty much all the Republicans in the area delegation. Some of them are giving thumbs up to the idea of payroll tax cuts and other kinds of tax benefits to employees and employers. Of course, that does have some impact on the overall budget, the federal budget. But nevertheless, they are seem more positive towards that. There seems to be a little bit of a divide, if you will. I don't know how much of one yet. We'll sort of see as time plays out. But McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, was pretty negative on pretty much the entire package that Obama proposed, and he called it pretty much more of the same failed policies that, in his view, had already failed to produce anything to turn the recession around. But he was probably the most negative. But you look at the House, and Boehner, House Speaker John Boehner of Ohio, sounded a lot more conciliatory, and so did House Majority Leader Eric Cantor of Virginia. By the way, that's where Obama went today, down to Richmond, right in Cantor's district.
Right.
But they were saying some of these proposals merited consideration. So, as you know, McConnell has been part of previous deals to get things passed through both houses. So we'll see if perhaps he does warm to the idea of some of these tax proposals. But he and a lot of the other Republicans are just absolutely adamant that they don't want to see any more spending, even though Obama, of course, has said that he will show them how this is going to be paid for.
What about the president's fellow Democrats? What are they saying?
John Yarmuth from the Louisville area and Ben Chandler from the Lexington area both seem to be, they want to see more details, but they're generally of a more positive mind towards this. But again, it looks, the early read on this is that this is going to be probably broken into various pieces and passed piecemeal. And of course, I think, I don't think the administration would necessarily be averse to that as long as, there is some promise that significant portions of this are being adopted. But as you just alluded to, and we just talked about, Obama's already out on the trail campaigning for this. He's calling it a jobs bill. They're not using the S word, stimulus, which has sort of gotten negative connotations in the minds of a lot of people, including the American public. But he's calling this a jobs bill. He called it a jobs bill time and time and time again last night. He very simply, urged Congress to pass this jobs bill, pass this jobs bill. I think that's going to be a mantra you're going to hear for the next several weeks out there. Very interesting thing, too. This morning, late last night, they started this, and this morning, the flood started. The White House has been sending out email notices each time somebody has said something positive about this jobs package. And each person who says something, or each organization who says something, be it a union or a lawmaker or whatever, mayors, governors, they each are getting their own little blurb in an email. So we've been flooded today with emails saying, Mayor X supports the jobs package. Governor X supports the jobs package. This union supports the jobs package. This organization supports the job package. And it's just been a flood of these. I don't know if we're going to be seeing this for the next several days. But obviously, they want to create this appearance, at least, that there's some momentum behind this package that he proposed.
This is State of the News on WFPL. We're talking with Jim Carroll, the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau, about the president's jobs proposal unveiled last night. You can give us a call at 502-814-8255, 814-TALK, or 877-814-8255. Send us an email at news@wfpl.org, news@wfpl.org. Also, send us a tweet, WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. Now, you mentioned spending, Jim. This is not really tied to this debt reduction process. What's the status of that commission that's been appointed to address those cuts?
Right. The committee has sort of started the engines. It's turned on the lights, and it's getting ready to go. They're actually sort of in the very early stages. It's a bipartisan panel. In the very early stages of looking at how to essentially deal with the debt entitlement programs, they pretty much have a very broad mandate and a very short calendar in which to complete their work. I mean, they have to be done by the end of the year, essentially. Actually, by Thanksgiving, they have to have their recommendations to Congress, and Congress has to move on them by Christmas. Which that's pretty much lightning speed in Congress time. So, but they are starting, and it is what Obama has proposed is totally separate from what they're looking at. Although it cannot be really separated in the reality of politics here, because if at a time when you're proposing, as Obama is, a package that is about $450 billion. And he says he's going to be paid for. Obviously, that has to figure into what the special debt committee is working on and how they're planning to further reduce the debt. And Obama, as you may have noticed last night, also promised that he was going to be sending along some additional proposals for further debt reduction. And so that will figure into, you know, deliberations by the committee.
Kind of a side note here, the president made his speech at 7 o'clock last night. The White House had proposed Wednesday night. Speaker Boehner said no, it conflicted with the GOP presidential debate. Then there were worries about conflicting with the NFL opener last night and somebody's bowling night or choir practice or whatever. It seemed like there was a time, you know, when the president requested a meeting with Congress and they said, yes, we'll be there. But maybe all the finagling was done behind closed doors back then.
Well, it's sort of a some of the analysts have said it's a pox on both their houses because, Congress accedes to a president's request to address them, but B, they also usually, the White House usually works it out ahead of time on what the actual schedule is, so you don't have this kind of public kerfluffle.
Right.
Obviously, the political atmosphere being what it is, sort of an elevated state of hostility in a lot of quarters. This sort of seemed to be a symbolic of the state of affairs, and obviously, you know, the public is fairly disillusioned with how Washington operates in general, and this sort of seemed to be took the cake,
I guess, in some ways. But it's a bump in the road, and of course now it's all over with. There are some realistic schedule problems with Congress anyway, because as many people may know, Congress had been on a break, and Monday was Labor Day, so they weren't here on Monday. So that left Tuesday. Well, they were just coming back on Tuesday, so that wasn't a good day. Friday today is the day that usually Congress goes home back to the district, so that's not a good day. So you can see the window was basically Wednesday or Thursday, and you had the beginning of the NFL season last night as well. So the speech was earlier than you would normally expect it. All these things had to be taken into account. But I think that, you know, what Obama wanted to do was to basically come out of the chute with the beginning of the fall congressional session, you know, with a solid proposal that he can immediately begin to try to sell to the American public and to Congress.
And finally, the 9/11 anniversary is approaching. We've had reports of unconfirmed threats in New York City and D.C. Are you seeing signs of heightened security around Washington?
You know, it's of a degree, because there has been people who visit here from all over the United States and even around the world often have said to me, I've never seen so much security. So ever since 9/11, really, Washington and New York have been places where you always see plenty of law enforcement everywhere. So it's a little hard to detect, when it's cranked up a little bit. There were plans in any case, because this is the 10th anniversary, to increase the security. So it was already ramped up, but I do know that, for instance, the Washington, D.C. police are now working on 12-hour shifts. I don't believe anybody has any leave for this weekend, and that's just the D.C. police. Of course, you have a lot of different law enforcement agencies throughout the city of Washington, but there's always a fairly heightened state of alert here because of what happened on 9/11. I was here on 9/11, and it was obviously extremely traumatic event for not only for Washington but for the nation. And D.C. is quite aware that, being the capital of the United States, we're an ongoing target.
You have plans to cover something on Sunday?
Personally, I do not at this time. I don't plan to. But I'm thinking about what happened on that day and all the people it's affected, and I'm actually going to be dealing with it in my Sunday column as well.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. James Carroll of the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau, thanks again for joining us.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
See ya. Take care.
This is State of the News on WFPL, and we're going to turn now to a colleague of Jim Carroll's, the Courier-Journal's Chris Otts is with us. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
And Chris wrote a preview article about how the jobs package unveiled by the president last night might be applied here in Louisville and this region. And you collected some numbers as to how that might be applied here, right?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, let me just give a basic overview of kind of where we stand.
Mm-hmm.
We lost about 41,000 jobs in the recession, and so far we've regained about 16,000 of those jobs. So kind of climbing out, but not there yet by a long shot. The unemployment rate locally, that's the 13-county Louisville, Southern Indiana metro area, basically the whole metro area, listening area, is 9.5%, and that's come down a little bit since January. It was about 11% at that time. And there's about 62,000 people estimated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics who are unemployed in the metro area. That's been as high as about 75,000 during the worst of the recession, so that has come down a little bit too. But before the recession, it was about 35,000, so that gives you a sense of the difference there.
You talked to some local business and government folks before the speech, but they had a pretty good idea what to expect last night.
Sure.
What have you been hearing from them?
Well, you know, the reaction obviously is mixed. You know, it kind of depends on where you are on the political spectrum. You know, even at the unemployment office, I've found it was really interesting to get a range of views. I was kind of expecting to hear people say, you know, yes, we should definitely keep those jobless benefits going like the president is proposing. But there are also some who say, you know, it's too long. You know, nearly 2 years of aid is too much, and I don't feel like I'm going to need that. But then again, there are plenty of people who said, well, it's nice to, you know, to have the security. And then also, it's interesting, you know, Obama has proposed kind of reforming the unemployment system too, and that was definitely unexpected. I mean, it was really clear that he was going to propose extending unemployment benefits. He had already called for that. But this reform of the system based on this Georgia program seems to be pretty interesting. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out locally and what the rules are going to be and how it affects people who are on that program.
Before the time gets away with us, you've also been reporting on the student housing situation at the University of Louisville and this concept of affiliated housing. What is that?
Well, it's the university was sort of stuck in a box where they needed new space for campus housing, but did not really have the ability to get those projects approved by the state and to build them themselves as a university. So they turned to private developers, and they just opened Cardinal Town, which is the third big basically apartment complex on the outskirts of campus this year, but they call it affiliated housing. The developers have an agreement with the university where the university markets the housing as U of L housing, and the university counts it in their housing goals, and they count about 31% of all full-time students living on campus or in these affiliated housing developments, which is up from 9% around 1998-1999. So it's quite an increase in the campus living situation there. They're trying to make it more of a residential and not so much of a commuter school.
And are these popular with the students?
They seem to be. I mean, the students that I talk to who live there certainly like it. I mean, you walk into these facilities, and it's pretty incredible the amenities they have, and certainly a far cry from my bunk bed college dorm that I remember. So, but they've got all sorts of amenities, you know, pool and lounges, big TVs, you know, lots of places to eat. So they're pretty neat places.
All right. Chris Otts at the Courier-Journal, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to hear about this effort at building backyard gardens, planting backyard gardens in the Tulsa, Oklahoma area. And we're going to talk to Abby Wendell of This Land Press. That's coming up next. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Rufus Newsom knows what it's like to be poor and hungry and dependent on the land. Growing up in Sunflower County, Mississippi, he chopped weeds out of cotton fields to help his mother pay the bills. To compensate for their inability to buy food from the grocery store, Newsom's family grew gardens filled with greens and potatoes. For them, urban gardening wasn't a trend, it was a means of survival. As an adult, Newsom moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma with his wife, Demalda Newsom. In 1995, they started a community farm in North Tulsa, Newsom Community Farms, and have helped more than a dozen families, churches, and schools build backyard gardens. We hear more about the Newsoms and their project in this report produced by Abby Wendell of This Land Press.
We weren't picking cotton. All we did was chop the weeds and all. You're chopping. It was hot. I imagine those rows being like 2 and 3 miles long. That's what I imagine. Of course, they wasn't that long, but it seemed like that, though. They were really long. I didn't know what a farmer was then. I knew what I was doing. I was good at it. I knew that. I was born in Mississippi in Sunflower County. We lived on property owned by whites, and this is what we did. We went to the fields. I started like when I was 11 years old. I was young. I was a young boy, really young. It wasn't just me, my brothers and sisters also. You started early in the morning. You started like 6 o'clock, and my mother always made a lunch for me. And she probably had like a peanut butter sandwich. And so you waited for your meal. You waited for lunch. And once that was over with, the day was almost over with. Once you had that lunch, then everything went quick. But I did that from 11 all the way up to 18 when I graduated from high school to make money for our school supplies and also for the household. It was good money for the work that I was doing because I knew I would come home and give it to my mother and she would buy things and pay bills. I remember that. I was from a poor family. My mother worked at a chicken factory. It was the only place that where blacks and whites could work together. She would bring home the leftovers, the chicken backs, legs and all, and this is the meat that we ate. We couldn't afford anything. And so we grew our vegetables, greens, sweet potatoes. My mother always said, boy, you can grow anything like your uncle. She never said a green thumb. She didn't know what that was, but she would say that all because I could grow almost anything, yeah. I could grow sweet potatoes in a refrigerator just as large as your head. I could do that. That's when I discovered I was a farmer because I worked with the soil. He that works with the soil is a farmer. My name is Rufus Newsom. We have a small community farm. We grow sunflowers, okra, corn, peas, beans, watermelons, cantaloupe, squash, herbs, chickens, fresh eggs, goats, rabbits, along with honey that we raise from our bees. We're trying to help our community by teaching them the value of good food, natural food. We've gone out to other families and we've helped them to set up their own backyard gardens. I don't know, at least over a dozen, maybe even more. There's a serious problem in the black community when it comes to self-sufficiency, like the food stamp program and welfare. And I'm not saying to get rid of it, but you have 2 and 3 generations that are on this program, and there seems to be no way of stopping it. A lot of these folks have kids and they have to eat. And being poor, and I know what it's like not to have food and all. But when you buying chips and hot dogs and candy and that's not helping their families at all either. I want people to experience what I did when I was younger at growing things, working with the soil and all, taste their own food, to taste natural food, so that they can be healthy and strong.
And you've been hearing the voice of Rufus Newsom. He and his wife, Demalda, run Newsom Community Farms in North Tulsa, Oklahoma. And this is a project that goes way back in Rufus's life in rural Mississippi. And that piece produced by Abby Wendell of This Land Press, who joins us right now. Hi, Abby.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Where are you? Are you in Tulsa?
I am in Tulsa right now.
So how did you get involved with the Newsoms and come to produce this piece?
I do a regular podcast for This Land. So I have one segment every month that comes out on farmers and ranchers. It's called Milk and Honey. And this month we wanted to look at something that was about like community-based farming as opposed to high-end organic farming or commercial farming. And it was actually an intern who said, my mom knows of a couple of community farmers up in North Tulsa. So he got me the contact information, and I set up an interview.
Have the Newsoms had a big impact in the Tulsa area?
I mean, I'm not really sure, you know, what the impact has been. It's hard work. You know, it's hard to get people interested in going out and getting dirty. And the people that they're kind of targeting are lower income people. North Tulsa is kind of the black section of town. And I think it's something like 35,000 people live in a 4-mile radius. And there's only one grocery store. So there's not a whole lot of consciousness about healthy food, natural food, but they've certainly had some impact. I mean, they've, you know, Rufus says he's started more than a dozen backyard gardens. He says in families' backyards. The piece that I had to edit out from that was he's also done it in churches and schools. So I think that that's probably where a lot of the impact is actually happening, because, you know, they've learned through their work that it's hard to get people from their generation, people that are in their 30s or 40s, to pay attention to something like this. But kids are, you know, they're excited. And if you can get mm-hmm. to them early, then they'll be interested in that. And they're the ones that will go home and talk to their parents about growing some tomatoes.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Abby. Thanks for joining us. Abby Wendell of This Land Press and in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks for sharing your piece with us.
Sure.
State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.